Today is Wednesday, April 14th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden said to announce pullout of U.S. troops from Afghanistan.
Essentially, the United States is going to pull all of its troops out of Afghanistan by September 11th.
Also, Burkina Faso's former president charged with killing his predecessor.
Sankara, a charismatic Marxist revolutionary often known as Africa's Che Guevara, was assassinated during a coup led by his former friend Compaoré.
Plus, at least 20 nursery school children die in Niger school fire. These stories and more are next. President Biden is set to announce his plan for pulling out all American troops out of Afghanistan nearly 20 years after Al-Qaeda attacks triggered America's longest war. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman shared the details with International Edition's Steve Miller.
Essentially, the United States is going to pull all of its troops out of Afghanistan by September 11th. Now, what is also interesting is there will be several thousand U.S. troops staying on the ground in Afghanistan beyond this May 1st deadline of this year that had been agreed to in a deal last year with the Taliban when Donald Trump was president.
Now, what does this mean in terms with the deal with the Taliban? Because during the past administration, final withdrawal of U.S. troops was always going to be conditioned based. And during the past year, after the deal was reached with the United States, there have been acts of violence that the Taliban has claimed. So, what is the Pentagon and other officials saying about those conditions on the ground that warrant this final withdrawal of troops?
Well, this really, according to the analysts you speak with, is not so much about the Taliban upholding conditions they agreed to, but rather about the United States deciding that after 20 years, it's time to get out, regardless of really what's happening on the ground in Afghanistan. And the Taliban were supposed to show up at a meeting this month that the Turks had announced, but now they're saying, according to one tweeted response, that they will not attend that meeting in Turkey until the United States removes all of its troops from Afghanistan. So a big question mark looming over the overall peace process for Afghanistan. But of course, that big question mark has been there for some time.
That's VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman speaking with my colleague Steve Miller. A coalition of NATO-led troops in Afghanistan will leave the country in coordination with a planned U.S. withdrawal by September 11th, Washington's top diplomat said on Wednesday, ahead of a formal announcement of the end of two decades of fighting. Around 7,000 non-U.S. troops from mainly NATO countries, but also from Australia, New Zealand, and Georgia, outnumber the 2,500 U.S. troops in Afghanistan, but they rely on U.S. air support, planning, and leadership for their training mission. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said in Brussels that it was time for NATO allies to make good on his mantra that allies went into Afghanistan together and would leave together.
This is an important moment for our alliance. Almost 20 years ago, after the United States was attacked on 9/11, together we went into Afghanistan to deal with those who attacked us and to make sure that Afghanistan would not again become a haven for terrorists who might attack any of us. And together, we have achieved the goals that we set out to achieve. And now it is time to bring our forces home. President Biden will speak to this in a few hours in the United States. And I'm here to work closely with our allies, with the Secretary General, on the principle that we've established from the start. In together, adapt together, and out together. We will work very closely together in the weeks and months ahead on a safe, deliberate, and coordinated withdrawal of our forces from Afghanistan. But even as we do that, our commitment to Afghanistan, to its future, will remain.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. The United States will deploy an additional 500 troops to Germany, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin said during a visit to Berlin on Tuesday, making a reversal of former President Donald Trump's plans to withdraw about 12,000 troops from the NATO country.
Today, I'm happy to announce that we will be increasing the U.S. force presence in Germany. In keeping with my pledge to consult with allies and partners, today I briefed the minister on our intention to permanently station approximately 500 additional U.S. personnel in the Wiesbaden area as early as this fall. Now, these forces will strengthen deterrence and defense in Europe, and they will augment our existing abilities to prevent conflict and, if necessary, to fight and win.
That's U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. China described its military exercise near Taiwan as, quote, combat drills, unquote, on Wednesday, hours before the arrival of former U.S. officials in Taipei on a trip to signal President Joe Biden's commitment to Taiwan and its democracy. Gloria Tso of Reuters reports.
Senior U.S. officials arrived in Taiwan on Wednesday as China steps up what it calls combat drills around the island. Taiwan, a democratic self-governed island which Beijing claims as its own, has complained of heightened Chinese military activity in its periphery in recent months. 25 Chinese aircraft, including fighter jets and nuclear-capable bombers, entered Taiwan's air defense zone on Monday, the largest incursion Taipei has reported to date. Chinese spokesman Ma Xiaoguang defended the exercises on Wednesday, calling them a, quote, necessary action and a solemn response to external forces interference. He added that the exercises are, quote, sending a signal that our determination to curb Taiwan independence and Taiwan-U.S. collusion is not just talk. Meanwhile, emissaries from the U.S. are visiting the island in what a White House official called a personal signal of the Biden administration's commitment to Taiwan. They are due to meet Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen on Thursday, who has repeatedly called Taiwan an independent country. Beijing was quick to condemn the meeting, with the spokesman, Ma, accusing the U.S. of, quote, playing the Taiwan card and continuing to send wrong signals to Taiwan independence forces. Ma further called the Taiwan independence cause a, quote, dead end, comparing it to the likes of drinking poison, which will only push Taiwan towards disaster.
That's Gloria Tso of Reuters. With tensions escalating between Russia and Ukraine, Turkey is finding itself caught in the middle. Ankara, anxious to get Russian COVID vaccines and tourist revenue, faces a difficult choice as Kiev seeks to purchase Turkish-made military drones. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
With Ukrainian and Russian forces facing off over Ukraine's Donbas region, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has come out in support of Ukraine.
As Turkey, we have clearly defended Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty.
One spoke during a recent meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. The two nations have a defense cooperation agreement, and analysts suggest Kiev is looking to expand its fleet of Turkish-made military drones.
The latest performance of Turkish drones in various conflict areas such as Syria, Libya, and Nagorno-Karabakh also seems to be stimulated Ukraine motivation in using and deploying those drones in the critical areas such as Donbas.
Last year, Turkish military drones gave Azerbaijan an advantage in its fight against Russian-backed Armenian forces over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. But the use of Turkish drones in Ukraine could raise tensions between Turkey and Russia. On Monday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned Ankara not to make further arms sales to Ukraine. Meantime, Russia has temporarily suspended most flights and tourist travel to Turkey, citing concerns over COVID infections, though some analysts see the move as a sign of Moscow's pressure. The pandemic has highlighted the complexity of Turkish-Russian relations. With Turkey struggling to find enough vaccines, discussions have continued on plans for Russia to supply and possibly co-produce the shots with Turkey. For now, analysts see Russia continuing to pressure Turkey over Ukraine, using vaccine cooperation as a reward and restrictions on tourist travel as punishment. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Iran has begun 60% uranium enrichment, the country's chief nuclear negotiator, Abbas Araki, told state media on Tuesday, a day after Tehran accused Arch4 Israel of sabotaging a key nuclear site. Araki made his announcement shortly before the resumption of talks in Vienna, aimed at reviving Tehran's 2015 nuclear deal with major powers an accord Israel fiercely opposed. Former U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned it 3 years ago.
We send a letter to the agency that we are going to add 1,000 more centrifuges to Natanz facility. That is in addition to the current number of machines. And also today, we just send a new letter to the agency saying that we would start from tomorrow enrichment up to 60%. And that is for Iran needs in to produce certain radioisotopes needed for certain medical treatments. The letter and DIQ has been sent today to the agency, and we would start this important job from tomorrow. Obviously, this is certainly according to our needs and in line with our NPT commitments.
That's Iran's chief nuclear negotiator, Abbas Araki. Attorneys for Derek Chauvin are presenting their arguments defending the now-fired Minneapolis police officer charging George Floyd's death. VOS Jesus Man Oni has more.
He says, "I can't breathe."
Prosecutors pursuing murder and manslaughter charges against Derek Chauvin gave way for his legal team to present their case on Tuesday.
Does the state have an additional witness?
Your Honor, the state of Minnesota rests.
Thank you.
Over the more than 2 weeks of testimony featuring police body cam and surveillance footage, eyewitnesses, medical experts, and law enforcement officers, prosecutors have argued that George Floyd died because Chauvin pressed his knee into Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes. Chauvin's lawyer, disputing that argument, called to the stand Barry Broad, a retired police officer who testified that Chauvin's actions were justified due to Floyd's frantic resistance.
I felt that Officer Chauvin's interactions with Mr. Floyd were following his training, following current practices in policing, and were objectively reasonable.
However, under cross-examination, he agreed that officers should stop or lessen use of force when it becomes unreasonable.
The defendant did not alter the level of force that he was using on Mr. Floyd, did he?
No.
Even though Mr. Floyd, by this point, had become, as you put, compliant. Fair?
More compliant, yes.
The defense is arguing that drugs and underlying health issues contributed to Floyd's death and that an unruly crowd distracted the police officers. Peter Chang, a Minneapolis Park police officer who was on the scene during Floyd's arrest, testified to the nature of the crowd.
Did you notice anything in terms of the tone or tenor of the voices of those people?
They were very aggressive. Yes, aggressive towards the officers, yes.
Meanwhile, just miles from where the trial is taking place, another fatal shooting of a black man by a police officer has escalated tensions in a community already on edge. President Joe Biden met with Congressional Black Caucus members Tuesday.
You know, Dante Wright in Minnesota, that god-awful shooting resulting in his death, And in the midst of an ongoing trial over the killing of George Floyd, we're in the business, all of us meeting today, to deliver some real change.
The death of Floyd, whose final moments were captured on bystander cell phone video, sparked outrage and protests denouncing police violence across the globe. Jason Samelny, VOA News, Washington.
You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Gene Adolfo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. At least 20 nursery school children died in Niger on Tuesday in a fire that trapped them in a straw hut classroom in a school in a poor neighborhood of the West African nation's capital, government officials said. Prime Minister Ahumadu Mahamudu, who visited the scene, promised to do everything so that if the cause of the fire is a crime, the perpetrators will be brought to justice. An official of a Niger's teachers' union said the school in the popular Pays-Based neighborhood had around 800 students, including children, in the nursery section. The International Organization for Migration says 160 Ethiopian migrants stranded in Yemen for months in dire conditions were flown home from Aden to Addis Ababa on Tuesday. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The International Organization for Migration returned the migrants home safely one day after at least 42 people died when a boat operated by smugglers capsized in the Gulf of Aden on its way to Djibouti. The boat was reportedly transporting some 60 migrants, including more than a dozen children who were escaping conflict in Yemen. The IOM says tens of thousands of impoverished migrants from countries like Somalia and Ethiopia make the perilous journey to Yemen every year in search of work in Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries. IOM spokeswoman Angela Wells says many never make it across the border and find themselves stranded in Yemen. She says more than 32,000 migrants, most from Ethiopia, are currently trapped in the country.
Many of them are in precarious situations, sleeping rough without shelter or access to any services. Others are in detention or being held by smugglers. The conditions of migrants stranded in Yemen have become so tragic that many feel they have no option but to rely on smugglers to return home.
Migrants are forced to pay smugglers large sums of money for dangerous journeys home that too often end tragically. Despite the risks, migrants desperate to return home continue to test their luck. Wells says just last month, at least 20 people drowned en route to Djibouti.
Since May 2020, over 11,000 migrants have returned to the Horn of Africa on dangerous boat journeys such as these, aided by smugglers. IOM's Voluntary Humanitarian Return Program provides a lifeline to those stranded in Yemen. We call on all governments along the route to come together and support our efforts to allow migrants safe and dignified opportunities to travel home.
Since October, the IOM has registered more than 6,000 migrants in Yemen who need help to return home. The agency says thousands of other undocumented migrants are waiting for their nationality to be verified and travel documents provided so they too can travel home one day. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Burkina Faso's former president Blaise Compaoré was charged on Tuesday over the killing of his predecessor, Thomas Sankara. David Doyle reports.
Burkina Faso's former president Blaise Compaoré has been charged in absentia in relation to the 1987 murder of his predecessor, Thomas Sankara. It's one of the most infamous killings in Africa's post-independence history. Sankara, a charismatic Marxist revolutionary often known as Africa's Che Guevara, was assassinated during a coup led by his former friend Compaoré. Compaoré then went on to rule Burkina Faso for 27 years. He was ousted in a 2014 uprising and fled to Ivory Coast, where he is believed to still live. He's previously denied involvement in Sankara's death. Sankara remains a hero for many in West Africa. He ruled Burkina Faso for 4 years, having seized power in a 1983 coup. In that time, he became the first leader to denounce the menace of AIDS, took a stand against the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, and promoted women's rights. On Tuesday, a military tribunal charged Compaoré with complicity in Sankara's assassination, undermining state security, and receiving cadavers. That's according to a court document seen by Reuters. Compaoré's former right-hand man, General Gilbert Diendéré, was also charged with several crimes, including complicity in the assassination. Diendéré, who has been in prison since a failed coup in 2015, was in court to hear the charges and will enter a plea later. Burkina Faso issued an arrest warrant for Compaoré in 2015, but Ivory Coast has declined to hand him over.
UN agencies warn northern Mozambique is facing a long-lasting humanitarian and protection crisis as conflict, hunger, and disease afflict hundreds of thousands of people in the region. We have Lisa Schlein again reporting from Geneva.
People are still fleeing in droves from the impact of the violence that erupted in northern Mozambique's coastal town of Palma. Many of the thousands of people who have fled to Pemba, the capital of Cabo Delgado, tell stories of the horrific attacks by Islamist militants who reportedly killed dozens of people and committed other atrocities. Speaking on a video link from Pemba, Director of Emergencies for the UN Children's Fund, Manuel Fontaine, says people relate how they have had to flee in the middle of the night. They speak in sorrow at families being separated while running for their lives.
I heard about this young woman was pregnant and her husband was just killed in front of her. And these are constant stories, stories of people being kidnapped, stories of gender-based violence, horrific stories of ordeals of people walking for days and days, kids arriving with their feet swollen and injured and having to be taken care of.
UNICEF says malnutrition rates among displaced children in Cabo Delgado are alarmingly high, with at least 33,000 in need of life-saving specialized nutritional feeding. It says cholera and COVID-19 are of growing concern. The agency has appealed for $52.8 million for Mozambique this year, $30 million of that amount targeted for Cabo Delgado. It says only 37% of the appeal is funded, and international support for its humanitarian operation is urgently needed. In a separate appeal, the World Food Program is seeking $82 million to ramp up food aid in northern Mozambique. WFP spokesman Thompson Theory says, in the wake of the heinous attacks in Palma, families and individuals have had to abandon their homes, their belongings and livelihoods to flee for safety.
WFP teams on the ground have spoken to these families that are on the move, and their stories illustrate horrific violence and deepening despair. As the security situation continues to deteriorate, more than 950,000 people in the north of Mozambique are now facing severe hunger.
Theory says the WFP plans to assist 750,000 internally displaced people and vulnerable members of the host communities in Cabo Delgado and three other northern provinces. He says WFP is organizing emergency food distribution for families who have fled the violence in Palma. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Myanmar army is attacking journalists and increasing censorship in its deadly crackdown against opponents of its February coup. Five major media groups have been banned and the internet has been shut down, but Burmese journalists are not giving up. For VOA, Steve Sanford reports from Mae Sot, Thailand.
On the walls of the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners, the Myanmar army's legacy of brutality during the 1988 crackdown is clear. The association, founded by former Burmese political prisoners living in exile, is working to help other political prisoners and document abuses. It posts daily updates on post-coup attacks on civilians, including those charged, arrested, or killed by security forces. While the military has banned five major networks and increased internet restrictions, the group says modern technology will help them get the truth out.
This era is the 21st century, a time of rapid development. No matter what the military tries to do to threaten our lives, they can't stop us from reporting the tragic news.
Media groups like Burma News International have gone remote, due in part to the COVID crisis, and rely heavily on the internet. But the decision this week by Myanmar satellite companies to stop international broadcasts of banned media groups has increased pressure to get the news out by any means.
This time we have to rely on the community journalists, you know, the CJ, and also like some of the stringers. Since there's internet like a limitation, we have to rely on the phone. We can get the information, but it's difficult to send the photos and video.
Civil society groups and rights activists have joined in the struggle, holding rallies in neighboring countries like Thailand. With help from migrants and exiles, many social media sites are able to repost damning video clips recorded in Myanmar's new conflict zones.
I want to give a message to the protesters inside Myanmar that if the military had cut off the internet, keep filming the video and take pictures of the evidence. Then send all the evidence you guys have to us when you have a chance. Then we will post that in the public.
As the Myanmar army continues to limit free expression and suppress the documentation of human rights abuses, media groups reach out to new contributors and old methods to get the facts out to the world. Steve Sanford for VOA News, Chiang Mai, Thailand.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.